You are now listening to the Claim It Podcast with me, your host, Tricia Huffman, your joyologist. On this podcast, whether I'm having a conversation, getting into the journey of someone who inspires and intrigues me's lives, or it's a solo reflection episode, my hope is for you to feel a little bit less alone on this wild and windy journey of being human. Because the world is noisy, and so are our brains. I hope that by hearing other people's journeys and perspectives, it gives you a lot more compassion for yourself, gives you some different perspectives to apply to your own life, reminds you of some things you may have forgotten, helps you get out of your own way, and reminds you to claim your freaking life in the now. That your joy, success, feelings of fulfillment, feelings of being enough are not out there in some external marker of what you think it should look like. It's all about how you feel in your day-to-day life, regardless of what goals and dreams you have yet to achieve or what you even got done today. On today's episode, I get to talk to Gina Malfa. She just released an amazing book, Moving On Doesn't Mean Letting Go, A Modern Guide to Navigating Loss. This book is so, so, so needed. And by the way, I think we all know this, but reminder that grief and loss does not just have to do with the death of someone. There are so many losses and reasons that we can experience grief without someone actually dying. So of course, we get into her journey, how she ended up as a therapist, and how she ended up writing this book, her first book about grief and loss. Why that topic? There's millions of topics people can write about, and especially therapists. All right, so I hope you enjoy the episode. If you don't already, hit the follow button. Subscribe to the podcast, and it would really mean a lot if you left a review and share it with your friends, share it on social media, tell people that you're listening and that you're enjoying, because let's get more people claiming their lives in the now. Here we go. So you can start even earlier than this, but I like starting with hearing about people's high school, teenage experiences. Like, what was life like for you? Where were you? Did you have any idea of what you were going to be when you grew up or anything like that?
Oh my God, high school. I have to be honest, sometimes I think I peaked at high school, which is unusual. I grew up in the Hudson Valley, lower Hudson Valley part of New York, just like 50 miles up the river. And I was a really big music, theater geek. I also was on my soccer team. Like, so I was really into soccer my whole life. And I was the vice president of the Crenarian Council of my whole school. So I was kind of like that overachiever in a moment, because I just wanted to know everyone and be involved in everything. But if somebody were to say, like, what do you know Gina Malfa for? And for me, like, what did I feel really defined high school? It was being in music and musical theater, and, you know, being the lead in the plays, and really thinking, actually, probably since I was a young kid on my elementary school stairs, charging for a concert, you know, thinking that I was going to be a famous singer and Broadway star. It was something I wanted since I was, I don't even know, since I could speak, since I was singing Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog in my kindergarten music class. So it's an interesting thing now that I'm a therapist, but I should talk to someone about that. But yeah.
I love that you also named Jeremiah. Like, I have not thought of that song.
I just brought you back.
And that you like named Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog, whatever song.
I do not joke around with Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog. If somebody's listening and did not hear that song, you have to rock out to it. They don't make music like they used to.
And what was, so you, did you get into musical theater at a young age, or like, what was it about that experience? Do you feel like that, like you were there? And you also said you were part of lots of things and that you wanted to just be a, like, was that generally it? You just wanted to be a part of things and wanted to be with people?
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, I had a lot of interests, you know, I was in little kicker soccer when I was four, you know, and also singing. So like soccer and, you know, being athletic and also being musical were kind of my two real passions. And I think the idea of wanting to be in like school politics was because I wanted to like, also, I always wanted to make changes. Not that you do in high school, right? It's not like there's anything monumental that you're ever going to get done, but the idea of running for office, like, you know, just knowing people and getting to know people and feeling like you're in this community was really, really cool for me. And I went to a really big school. It had like 4,000 people in it. So it was like going to college early on, my high school. So it was, yeah, I mean, I think it was about wanting to be around different people, but also these people and these activities spoke to different parts within me.
And you ran for student council or whatever it was called. And you once, so that too, and you said it was a very large school. Mm-hmm. That would, there's no, I mean, I didn't want to be a part of my school stuff at all. Like I loved people, but I didn't want to have anything to do with my like schools really. Like I barely made it to school, but I got good grades. I did enough. Like I always like calculated like, all right, great. I can do this and miss this day. But like also the idea of vote for me, choose me, especially in those ages, like I can't wrap my head around.
Yeah, it's so interesting because it's funny that you say that now.
Like, I cannot, and even now I'm like, I am confident in who I am. And also like, I can see it somewhat now, but it's still just like, not really anything. But I'm like, yeah, like in high school being like, everyone vote for me.
I was not Elle Woods.
Yeah. Not saying whatever, but just whatever your personality was, just still that's, you have to be, I'm running, vote for me, campaign, I'm the best person. Why am I the best person? This is why you want me. Like you're selling yourself to these people.
You really do. And it's funny because I started running for office in sixth grade when I was in Mrs. Cooper's class at Meadow Hill School. And I remember it like it was yesterday. But what's so interesting is that I feel like my confidence went backwards, right? Like I had so much confidence when I was young because I think I was more myself. I didn't know any other way to be than just kind of me and surround myself with people who saw me for me, right? And it was like, I think as I got older, that changed for me. And I feel less, not that I'm not confident, but I definitely feel more insecure and impostery than I did in Mrs. Cooper's sixth grade class, or, you know, in 11th grade, you know, running for Canarian Council president or vice president. So yeah, it's so interesting that you say that because I haven't thought about this in like ever. I never really thought about it again, but yeah, the confidence piece of it is like, I felt like I wanted to relate to who people were. And I wanted to genuinely be friends with them. And so I think running for student council, like I met new people in my little campaign. And I made new friends and I just felt like I related to people in different ways than I hadn't before. So in a way, that's still something I do now. I still want to go around and get to know people and see what their needs are and what's happening. But yeah, I was so much more confident when I was little Gina. It's sad.
So what happened? So in high school, you were still doing musical theater. You were the lead, did you say?
I was usually the lead. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of just the way it went. Isn't that funny? It was like, I just sort of, yeah. You know, when we did things, there were, you know, there was the solos and all of that. And in high school, I sang on a children's album with Carole King's daughter and, you know, sang with Carole King, you know, did a duet with Carole King, You Got a Friend, and then performed with her at Hard Rock Cafe in the city. And yeah, it was just such a thing where I really thought this was my path. And yeah, so interesting.
Was that like, did Carole King's daughter like go to your school or something? Is that how that came about or something totally?
She didn't. She was just doing auditions for these children's albums that she was doing called Sugar Beats. And this one particular album was called You've Got a Friend, and she came to my high school and auditioned people, and I got chosen out of my high school. And and then we started going to the recording studio, and
then you were even singing it on stage with Carole King, because I'm guessing everybody who auditioned or even made the album was probably not on stage.
I was the only one. I think there was one other person who did a song with her, but that was it. And at the time, I didn't know really who she was, right? So I walk hand in hand with her to my mom, who loved her, who had her Tapestry album on repeat over and over. And I walk hand in hand and I'm like, this is my mom. She really wants to meet you. And my mom like couldn't even say anything. She was so in shock that here I am just strutting over with Carole King, like not even a care in the world.
I have no idea. Wow.
Yeah, I didn't really understand how famous she was. So to me, she was just sort of the grandmother. what a legend. Now I'm like, oh my God, that was so cool. How did I do that? I was just, That's why I think I say I peaked during those years, because that was like the me and my rock star era. And now I don't know. Now I don't know what era I'm in.
You're in the changing people's lives era, deeply healing them era.
All right. If you like this, no.
So what happens at high school and as you're getting close to graduation, are you thinking, I'm going to Broadway, I'm doing this? Where did you want to go and where did you go?
Yeah. So at the time, I wasn't sure that Broadway was it, but I wanted to major in music. And I wound up getting kind of like a full scholarship to study with Renee Fleming's, the opera singer's masterclass teacher. Her name was Merla Aikman. And I wound up getting a full ride to go to the Crane School of Music, which was up in Potsdam, New York. And to be honest, though, it wasn't a good fit for me. And I didn't wind up staying there. I loved the music experience there. And I loved being a part of growing and all of this stuff. But it wasn't really the whole music school after high school was a huge letdown for me. And so, that's where the story goes down like this, where you're like, oh, okay, here I thought I was going to do this thing. And then I felt like I was really disillusioned by all of it. You know, you forget about the competition and, you know, the pressure. And yeah, it just felt like, and also just the spending my time learning songs I didn't want to sing, and, you know, singing in French and German and Italian and all of these languages to do something that I didn't want to do anymore, which was, you know, studying vocal performance. I didn't need a degree to say I could sing, you know? So that was pretty short lived. It was like a year. And then I transferred.
Do you think when you were like, okay. Yeah. And also, what made you, because you didn't need a degree to sing. Was there something inside of you or other people that were like, well, you have to get a degree, so then do music? Or like, you know, or were you just like, that's what we do. We go to high school and then we get a college degree. So let me be more educated in this thing that I want to do. If I want to sing, then let me educate myself.
Yeah, I think that was it. You know, and my mom was like, Gina, if you're going to do this, like you should get a music education degree. So you have something to fall back on, and, you know, you've got to have the safety. And so for me, it was, so the way my high school went, it was like little schools of professional studies almost. So I was in this music department, and almost all of my classes senior year, outside of like honors English, or, you know, I was taking intensive Italian, something like that, it was all music. And so our whole kind of cohort, that was what we were going to all do. And so we didn't really think about it. It was just like, now we are in this music program and we'll go to music school and we will all be famous. That was sort of the things that we thought about, right? And so we didn't really think farther ahead. And there's my mom, like, you've got to do music education, because if you don't have that education degree, you're really just going to be like waiting tables. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but you're really bad at your balance. And like, you know, and so... You know, my mom's like, you can't even carry anything to the table. You're going to like, you can't do this. And like, you know, and I'm like, there's more to do. I could be a receptionist. You know, this is like 20 years ago. She's like, you don't even like talking on the phone. Like there were so many things. So, you know, so needless to say, I didn't want to be a music teacher, although I respect every one of them. They changed my life growing up, especially with Jeremiah Elizabeth Frog. But
So you went to this school, were there for a year, didn't work out, and then what did you decide to do from there?
So I decided to transfer and go into a totally different field, and I had no idea what I would be going into whatsoever. And I just
I'm not going to study music. Let me keep going to college. And like, then just you transferred and not knowing what you would major in, but like, okay, maybe studying music is not what I need to be doing.
Exactly. So I came back to New York downstate. I wound up going to Fordham, and I found in the cafeteria this lady who was getting a salad, and she was lovely, and I was right behind her in line, and she introduced herself as the dean of the international relations program. And I was like, that sounds great. Sounds good to me.
International relations.
Right? You are like, Gina, what the hell path? I did tell you ahead of time, it's a messy little path.
No. But I was like, oh no, I'm intrigued by the international relations.
Yeah. So I wound up majoring in international studies and having a psych minor. And what I loved about it though, at that time, I was like, oh, I'm going to be a lawyer because this is what I'm going to do. I'm really passionate about the world. I studied abroad. I started studying all of this international relations and sociology and all of this. I wound up studying abroad in England and working at the U.S. Embassy. And I found this whole new side of myself.
And you enjoyed it. You were like,
I did.
Because it sounds kind of, you fell into, oh, that sounds cool. Great. Sign me up. And then you actually were engaged in it.
Yeah. Well, you know what it was, is to me, it sort of did connect back to high school. Like I had a really diverse high school, and I love different cultures. I love learning about culture. I love kind of just understanding more. And I believe education is the route to peace in general. And so to me, I sort of was like, okay, I really love culture. I love studying this. And I also love understanding why people do what they do in culture, right? So that was how I kind of blended together those two things and wound up studying, kind of doing a thesis in the end, which was research for a couple of years on terrorism and the psychological aftermath of PTSD. And then I know.
Just a light. I'm sure there's like of anything you could have chosen.
I was so.
Terrorism and the psychological. Well, for someone who was not, I'm going to be a psychologist, whatever.
Not at all. These are like, that's why I'm like, this story is not at all linear. Like life is.
I love it. No, that's why I like getting into people's stories, to give other people permission to like, yeah, like what it does. Your past doesn't have to make sense. You can try something else right now. You feel pulled to something. It doesn't matter. Follow this little nudge. Follow the person that has salad in front of you that says they're doing this. Why not check it out?
It's so true. You know, when I think back on it, though, they all relate in some way. You know what I mean? So it's like, I wanted to study culture. So the international studies, we were trying to really understand why certain what is the difference between religious war and stuff like that? And so I got into that. I was really fascinated by terrorism and sort of what was the psychology behind it. And what was the creepiest part of the whole thing is that was the year. So I graduated in 2001 with my thesis, and 2001 is when September 11th happened here in New York. And so it was really interesting because I was living then and witnessing everything I was writing about, because at that time, nobody understood what PTSD was. It was just something that was considered associated with Vietnam and war syndrome. And so that was when I really sort of was delving into, wow, this is it right here. This trauma, this thing that everybody around me in the city is experiencing. In fact, everyone around the world is experiencing along with New York. This is where I need to be. And I wound up, really changing course and deciding that I wanted to study trauma. And how do I do that? And so that was really how I segued into what I am now doing and what I started to do. So that was, the beginning. I went to NYU after that in 2002, just as I graduated, and started studying social work and mental health and human behavior, always knowing that I wanted to do work in trauma. And so after that, I went to the NYU School of Medicine that had a trauma studies program, and I got a certification in trauma. And that's kind of how it all happened. So it's a really interesting kind of line that was very jagged. But in a way, I wonder if September 11th didn't happen, if I would have wound up in law school or something like that. It really did change the trajectory of my life in a very outside way. So yeah, so that's kind of how it all started. So you got my whole high school Gina to the Gina that had no idea what to do and she didn't want to be a musician anymore to like, wow, something big happened and I see. And what a coincidence that I was studying that before it happened. And
yeah, that is bananas. I think I wasn't tracking, you know, not even thinking of age and stuff like that. I just assumed when you said terrorism that it would have been after, because that was like the biggest terrorism. Well, that people living in the United States, like especially in us younger people, I'm 42. I'm still younger. Whatever, but you're right. Like that we like lived. You're older than me?
I sure am.
Wow.
I am 2 years older than you just passed this week. This week was my birthday.
Oh, and happy birthday.
I am, yes, I'm older than you.
So I would not have guessed that. We both look good.
That's sweet of you. We're of the same age. We're of the same age, basically.
Yeah, but like, so that, yeah, that is so interesting because when you said you stuttered that, then it sort of, in my mind, it would have been because, yeah, like you had already lived through 9/11 and that would have brought that more up. So that is bananas. And so then after that happened and you were like, okay, I want to do work and study trauma. Did you know that you would want to be working with clients or because you can also become like, right, research therapist? Mm-hmm. I'm not great at like terms of things. I'll be like, I'll even be like, wait, is it therapist or psychologist or psychologist, whatever. But did you know, like, I want to work with trauma, like I want to work with people or I want to study trauma and write research papers and such, or just, I don't know, but let me go this route.
Mm-hmm. I definitely always knew I wanted to work with people. I didn't at the time want to be in private practice. So now I am, but I didn't want to. For the majority of my career, I was not in private practice. I wanted to work with groups of people and I wanted to work with people who had faced really heavy atrocities. So it was like asylum seekers, survivors of torture. Inevitably, I started working with older adults who were, most of them were Holocaust survivors. And so that is sort of kind of where I landed more of the time. And, you know, at the end of the day, I wanted to always say, look, I want someone to be able to walk through my door and I'm going to know how to help them. And you can't do that unless you're working with basically everyone. and you have so many different scenarios that you've done and you've worked with and you've gotten different training and whatever, but you're really in the trenches. So that no one who walked through my door, I would be like, oof, that's a lot. I don't know that I can do that. It's like, nope, you've survived. We can do it. Let's do it. If you've survived, you can heal.
And especially I assume too, because I obviously, you know, I don't know all of personal story up to that point too, but like, yeah, you can study to be a psychologist, a therapist, or whichever, and then you're taking these clients and you have studied these things, but then also it's much different than if you haven't been through, not even like been through the same experience, but like, yeah, like lived it in your body in sort of a way to then know like, okay, like I make up that has to be a huge thing that they must have to prepare people for in college. It's like, great, here's the information and here's the test and this, and we know that you know it, but do you know it in your body to be able to really hold that space for people and not just, here is the way that I talk to you, the way and I treat you. I make up. I don't like, yeah, like what is that like?
OMG, it's finally here. My daily text message subscription. Text messages. That's right. You don't have to go on social media where you'll for sure find things that inspire you, but will also maybe find things that frustrate you. And you'll forget the inspiration as soon as you see it, right? Like, love that quote. Maybe even reshare it and then move on because you get lost in all the other stuff. Same things with email inboxes. I love sending out messages. I love my Substack community, From the Heart, where I am sending out messages 3 to 5 times a week in written and audio form. And text messages. I'm sending you love right to your text. No matter where you live, international phone number, or the USA, every single day get a text from me that loves you up, that gets you out of your own way, that reminds you what matters, that nudges you into action, into your heart, reminding you that this is your life and it's happening now. Go to yourjoyologist.com/text and use code JOY3 to get a discount on your first 3 months. Ready, set, go. yourjoyologist.com/text. Use code JOY3.
I think I don't have to jump off of a cliff to know that it's dangerous, but
and it's impossible to live through everything that everybody's gone through, but just even like,
yeah,
to be in yourself enough, I guess, to be able to even experience like, oh, shame, this, oh, Trump, like, whatever. It's not have to be the same, but just even a knowing.
Well, I had been through, I mean, I've been We've through all trauma been through. In my life, yeah, right? Like, so it's not like I wouldn't understand that, you know, my nervous system and the sense of, and of course, shame is the biggest one of all. But you know, what's so interesting is that Americans more than the Western society, more than anyone else, feels that shame of self. And so, you know, you start to learn that other cultures have a lot more resiliency than we do. And so that was one part of my learning with the people. I think for me, I wanted to just tangibly help, right? So asylum seekers needed me to do, you know, assessments and advocate in court. And I had a job to do that was not necessarily about their healing, but about actual their ability to actually assimilate and be an American citizen. And so that was a really big, important task. And I feel like that was the beginning of, you know, being able to hear something, but not have the responsibility of helping them heal, but witnessing their story with care and warmth and respect, and also then using that to do something good. And that was sort of how it all started. Just the idea of listening, witnessing, holding space, you know, containing stories. That to me is still one of my joys. Like, what a privilege it is to hear someone's story, you know, of shame or of trauma or of survival, of loss. So, you know, that's really how it all kind of started.
I was going to say, I feel that even in relationships, friendships of different types, right? And I've made so many friendships with people on social media that maybe I don't know in person, but we've created relationships like that. And so going through the writing a book process and authors, so like you become friends with people that you don't really know. And I've had some of those people, or just even old friends from different things. And then people will be like, oh, I'm so sorry for unloading on you, or thank you for, and I'm like, are you kidding me? I feel so honored that you consider me a safe space to that. Like, I'm here, like, because I'm not able to, like, I am able to, like, I'm not going to take it on. Like, yes, let me just, because I also know how important that is to just be witnessed, to be heard without getting the, like, advice and all that is great. But like that, so I'm always feel like, please, I am so honored. I'm so honored that you felt safe with me to open this up. So, but that's where you started. With asylum seekers and that, which, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. And then really just from there, it was, I mean, look, I think in this field, what I love about starting out to be a therapist is that you really get to see, you get to try on things and you get to see where you fit and what you're good at and what your limitations are. I think one of the things I have trouble with these days are therapists that say they do everything. I can help everyone, right? For me, it was like, well, I could do this for a little while and I can do this for a little while, and let me see what I'm good at and let me see what within these things I'm both passionate about, won't get burnt out on, can be helpful doing, and I'm not like taking on more than I can chew. And, you know, so within these few years, you know, I wound up training therapists in addictions settings and, you know, working at a large non-for-profit called the 92nd Street Y here, where I did work with Holocaust survivors and take their stories. And that's where I started doing grief work, you know, running grief groups within this population. and realizing, yes, they have so much trauma, but nobody is ever talking about their loss. No one is talking about what was left behind. And we're talking about survival and, wow, rebuilding and how wonderful. And yes, it is. And yet, what about all that was lost, all who was lost? And so that, you know, that was a really big part for me of like feeling to myself, okay, I know now as a therapist, and I'm sort of in the middle of my career, the early stages, but mid part of it. I don't know if it's middle, but I'm several years in, and I realized that I wanted to work with trauma indefinitely in some part of my life always. And yet, you know, the joy of trauma, and I say this sarcastically, is that it's everywhere and it's in all, you know, if you look at mental health in general, it's everywhere. If you look at anything, somebody has experienced trauma of some kind, whether relational trauma or an event or an experience or prolonged repeated trauma. And so to me, it was like, this is where my home is, and how I work around that is going to be sort of the joy of my life and how I actually find that meaning and fulfillment. And it was inevitably within trauma and grief together. And it was, you know, and look, grief is in substance use disorder. Grief is in mental health and mental illnesses, right? It's everywhere. And we still think that everything's very separate, but trauma and grief is in every part of the mental health spectrum. And so that's where I really found my home.
Yeah, but I'm going to go back. I want to talk about that. I'm going to go back with working with the Holocaust survivors. And you said like they hadn't really a good place to like talk about what is lost. Is that because, I guess, you know, it's so many ways like you made it, you survived, like that there's such a focus on them as a survivor, which yes, you're alive, you made it out. But then so that, yeah, there really isn't though that holding space for all that they've lost. That there's just most of their lives from making it over here is just the focus on you're a survivor. So like how amazing for you, survivor without then, but nobody can maybe see the like and everything else that you lost.
Yeah. Well, like, look, we didn't even have a word for trauma until 1979, 1980. So, you know, nobody really understood what they had experienced, and mental health wasn't a thing. You know, I mean, sure, it was a luxury at that point. So people were taught to just come here and pull yourself up by your bootstraps and keep it moving. And so it wasn't as if the trauma disappeared, but it was really just shoved it down. And it wasn't necessarily even about the rebuilding, but it was like, let's just move forward. And yeah, I mean, when I heard these stories and when we had the groups, it was just, I feel like it was probably the most humbling job I've ever had, where I just was like, wow, I don't know what it would be like for 40 to 50, 60 years to just never acknowledge.
Yeah, because these are people in their like, what, 80s and 90s that are now in a grief support for something. I mean, they've lived through for many years, but the main loss was, yeah, 50, 60 years ago. Wow.
Yeah. And this was back, you know, I started there in 2008. So, you know, this is going a ways back, you know, now many of the Holocaust survivors are no longer with us, which is really sad because it feels like that history is sort of going with them. So again, like most things, you hope that we remember what the humans are capable of, but also that people need support, people need community, and that loss and trauma are with you forever. You know, these were people in their 90s, you know, I had somebody I was very close with in her late 80s, and, you know, she had never spoken about some experiences that had happened with her during the war and trying to survive. And, you know, to be that age and carry that heavy load, I mean, it was just to me. And here I am, a pipsqueak of a person, you know, having the privilege of hearing that. I mean, I was blown away. I mean, it was such a, even right now, I like lose words for how honored and how humbled and what a very big gift that was to be able to bear witness and be on that road with them, you know, and to talk about loss and to explore grief. So, yeah.
And so where did you decide, like you said, working in that and some other experiences, you were like, okay, trauma and grief, I want to spoke there. And so what then led you to starting a private practice? Because you were like, no, that's what I don't want to do. Like, were there more moments or interactions? Like, what led you to then going that direction?
I think, you know, there were a couple of things, but I think that I never wanted to. I don't believe that people should graduate, and I'm going to get a lot of slack for this, but I don't believe people should graduate from school and go straight into private practice. I think there are a lot of people that do that. There are a lot of schools that that's what they do. I think that you have to get your feet wet and see where your strengths lie and go in that direction of really getting to know the mental health field inside and out as much as possible. And work with groups of people that are marginalized or oppressed. You know, I think it's a fancy thing to go straight into private practice. And I wasn't into the fancy road. I wanted to get my feet dirty and my feet wet and wet and dirty, I guess. But, you know, there was a time where I realized at this point in my life, like I became the clinical director of an outpatient program at Mount Sinai Hospital here. And I loved my work and I loved what I was doing, but I was missing the clinical work. And so I decided to start a small private practice in addition to my clinical, being the clinical director and administrative work. And more people kept calling me. And I just was like, you know what? Maybe it's time. We're losing funding at this program. It's, you know, they're looking to close it. So, you know, maybe it's time. And a lot of shifts kind of happened. And it sort of naturally happened that one day I had more and more and more clients calling me and coming to me, and that I just decided to have my office full time. And the rest is history, really. And I never looked back. And it's so interesting because now I'm like, oh, I love this freedom, you know, like, I can't believe it. But it's hard too, you know, it has its exhaustion too, working for yourself.
Yeah,
I run a tight ship.
And how did that, you said people kept like texting you, were those people that had like worked with you through programs you were doing with other things, like, Or just yeah. people you knew that knew you were a therapist and like, oh, can I recommend somebody to you or something like that? Like, yeah, where did the clients come from?
Yeah, it was all of it. It was really all of it. It was people that I knew from other programs I had worked at that heard I was in private practice, that they were like, oh my God, thank God, we've got referrals for you. And there were people who I had known from, you know, who were clients earlier in a different program, not many. And then I had, you know, a profile on Psychology Today and got a lot of calls from that. And so it was really, it was sort of a slow progression of clients over a period of time, but then very quickly at once it started happening. But yeah, I would say it was word of mouth really outside of all of this, because it wasn't until much later that I started my Instagram account. And, you know, it's mostly not for clients, but, you know, to get a book deal.
Well, speaking of the book deal, had you known for a while that you wanted to write a book? Like, where did the idea come from to write a book, and specifically one focused on grief?
I always wanted to write a book. I didn't know what it would be on, but during the pandemic, so now we're fast forwarding.
And you had already had your private practice.
Yes. Now I would have had my practice many years, but I would say, you know, during that time, I had a lot of people calling me. It was a point in my career where I could not keep up with the phone calls. I couldn't keep up with the emails. It was that this whole country just could not find a therapist during that time. And there was just, so, I mean, I felt so terrible. I just couldn't, I don't know. There just wasn't enough time in a day. I needed more than two hands. And I remember clients saying to me, and I work with a lot of younger clients, emerging adults, who are like, we need something else. You know, this is great, but I've lost my whole family to COVID, and I, you know, I can't afford to come to you more, but I need something else. And it dawned on me that, yeah, not only could a lot of people not afford therapy, but a lot of people didn't have access to a trauma-informed grief therapist. So one of my clients was like, you know, you keep referring me to these books, but I don't relate to them. You know, a lot of these books are written by maybe older people and they're more memoirs or they're more about losing their spouses. And for me, I like what you tell me. Like, you give me a lot of practical things. Like, can you write a book? Like, can you, you should do it. And, you know, it was sort of like a passing thing. And I laughed and I was like, oh, okay, right. And then, you know, I was hearing it again. And it was a couple of weeks later, I started to think like, well, wait a minute. Like, I've been doing this work a while. Like, why not me? Why other people? And why not me? If there's a way that I can create the experience of being in therapy and having actual tangible tools to get through a time in your life that feels completely upending and help you navigate that, then like, let me give it a try. And I had really no idea what would come of that idea. I just decided to write a proposal and I got help writing a proposal without really wondering, you know, if it would get anywhere. And it quickly did. And I wound up getting fabulous, kind, wonderful, funny agents at Folio Literary Management. And they sold my book to auction. My book went to auction and that was sort of it. And it went very quickly. And I think for me, what it spoke of was not necessarily me, but the need to have this conversation and the need to have somebody provide access to help and support at a time when the whole world was on fire. I mean, none of us really knew. And to be honest with you, we've never been the same. we don't really know the effects of the pandemic on us. You know, grief is the biggest burden people are now carrying. And it's not just death-related losses. So it felt important to me to try to just bring this to a conversation, you know, bring this conversation to the table.
Whether you're someone who has used protein powders before or has never, trust me when I tell you that adding Sprout Living's epic protein line into your life will make a huge difference. I'm someone that for years and years and years and years and years had a smoothie almost every single day. And I went through so many protein powders. Some of them taste gross. They're overly sweet. They aren't sweet at all. They have lots of different filler, random ingredients. When I toured as a joyologist, I was often making smoothies daily for myself and for other people. And it took a long time because I would have a bajillion ingredients that I put in there. That's why I was so happy to find Sprout Living. Their blends are delicious and made with the best ingredients. I don't add anything else often. Sometimes I seriously just put the scoops in a water, like shaker bottle with water, and drink it like that. Lately, I've been adding a scoop to plain vegan yogurt and adding berries for breakfast or a snack. Maybe do frozen spinach, frozen banana, and water in a smoothie. But they have such amazing ingredients and they freaking taste good. Because I love food. I like to eat things that help support my body, but it has to taste good. Their flavors are amazing and everything they put in is so mindful and purposeful. It isn't just protein, there's nootropics. There's superfoods, adaptogens, prebiotics. And again, the flavors are delicious. For me, it's the perfect sweetness. Like Mindful Matcha is one of the blends. I am so picky about matcha. This matcha flavor is so good with the perfect amount of sweetness. So go check out Sprout Living at sproutliving.com. Use code CLAIMIT for 20% off of anything. Try. They have sampler packs of the flavors. Like I said, all the flavors are so good. I've been lately doing like the ant or Green Kingdom one, which is more greens and spirulina and stuff in it. Even that one tastes really, really great. Everything that they do is so high quality. You can hear my conversation with the founder, Mark Malinsky, on a previous podcast. Go check them out. Sproutliving.com. Use code CLAIMIT for 20% off. Trust me, it's an easy way to be adding more protein and valuable nutrients to your body on a daily basis. As you said that you did, and you probably still recommend other books, grief books, people going through things. I was not aware. And when I lost my dad in 2008, suddenly, so I was 27, I guess. Yeah. Like, let me do the math.
Math is hard.
And I had lost people before that, but I think maybe like family members, but not like super close. But when my dad died, it was such an interesting experience. But no, like he died suddenly, and I was very much like so shaken up, so blown away, and also like, okay, that's what happened. I guess, you know, this is what needed to happen, and I can see why this sucks and the timing, like intellectualizing, I guess, this idea that my dad had a weird thing happen and he died and he was young and happy. But wow, we had a phone call 2 days ago. It was like the most amazing phone call in the world. And it did kind of like, you know, like it was like these things all like lining up, and it was just like, wow, okay, so I can see how this had to happen. Or like I was trying to like make meaning out of... Yeah. No.
Tough meaning.
Yeah. No, she's like giving a thumbs down for people who aren't watching. But I'm, too. Like, you know, like, but it was just so, like, so accepting it. And also then, like, flew home. I was supposed to be going to fly to leave to Australia for a tour that day. Instead, flew home to see my family. And then, still, as soon as the funeral was over, flew to tour. And I, wasn't like, I just didn't know what else to do. And I didn't want to be with my family in Ohio. And I didn't really like, my life was on tour, and the tour I was supposed to be on was like my family. So I was like, yeah, I want to be with these people. And I love touring and I love travel. And so I went right to tour, and I was a mess. Like, just like, and that also, I had never really given myself permission to feel or cry in public before that. Like at the funeral, I was like, I wouldn't let myself cry. And I was fighting with myself. You're at your dad's funeral. You're allowed to cry. Don't cry. Like I was just like, so would not, like I just had embodied, I am strong. I'm this, I'm positive. I don't know, for so long. So like had this moment, and everybody like left and I couldn't get up. My friends were like hugging me and I couldn't stand up. And I just like knew that I had to let it go, but I wouldn't. So I was like just sitting there like alone. And finally, like sobbing, like the most disgusting, like a lion is dying, was how I sounded probably.
Aww.
Just good. Letting it out. And I was like, this is disgusting. Like hearing this voice and be like, it's okay. Like let it out, whatever. And I was like, now I feel like I want to like lay on the ground in front of his picture because we had him cremated. No, don't do that. That's weird. And like, it's your father's funeral. You can do whatever you want. Like did the thing. Even a family member tried to like get me up and remove me. And I was like, no. I need to do this.
Good.
I'm fine. You can like, I'm not fine, but like, please leave me alone. And so from that moment on, I was like, I'm no longer fighting emotions. And when tears come, let the tears come. And I did. So I'd be like on, like behind the sound console, sobbing.
No.
I'm laughing, but I'm like. Yeah.
And you're again, laughing but, now, but man.
I probably was laughing while it was happening too. I'm just like, oh, all right. But again, I still felt so at home there, and I didn't know where else to be. I kept touring for a couple of weeks, and everything like changed for me. I just wanted to shake people on the streets, which led to all the things. But I eventually did. I was like, I can't do this anymore. I said, I'm no longer doing sound, and I like quit my life. Like I could have been like, I need a break. I'll come back for the summer leg of the tour. I said, I am no longer doing sound ever again. And I...
You sound like me when I quit music school.
And I found somebody to replace me. I did it responsibly or whatever. But then I still was like, what the fuck am I doing? Went to Thailand, ran away for a couple weeks. But I went to the bookstore and I was like, let me be like standing in front of the personal development section. And I bought a ton of books. I don't remember seeing anything about grief. If there was a book about grief, there probably was, and it just wasn't. I think a Pema Chodron book. I don't know if that's how you pronounce her.
Pema, yeah.
Yeah, but what's, I'm sure you would know, maybe there's like a book about loss or maybe not.
Her book now about loss, I have it right here. is how we live. How we live is how we die. But
no, there was so a
different
been...
one. Yeah, there was a different one, which is somewhere else on my shelf.
I know.
Here.
I'm all like, do I have it still? But anyway, so like that was helpful. But they're really like, I didn't see like, I don't remember anything. And that whole entire time, I like, yeah, and I like took a year off. I don't know what I'm gonna do with my life. This, I ended up like, okay, I want to just take people up to doing live. But I like quit my life when my dad died. and it was great and it was beautiful. And that's where I gave up the word should. That led to all of this and it led to all these different things. But nobody, I didn't have any resources. I didn't have any friends that knew how to talk to grief. I didn't have any like we had my mom and dad were divorced also and she was remarried. So that was thing about like my sister. Yeah. I mean, so we would talk, but, and I just remember prior to this, I guess Angelina Jolie maybe had lost her mom several years before. And I remember like that she would like in many interviews bring up like her mom's death. And I remember being like, didn't that happen like a year ago? Or like a part of me being like, what? And then I was like, once I like lost my dad, I was like, oh, okay, I get it. And since then, every time I know anybody who loses anybody, it's so interesting because I do like, I got you, I'm here, but I still don't know what the fuck to say. And I will be like, grief is such an interesting experience. Like we all experience it. And yet I don't really, know what to do to tell it. Like, you know what I mean? It's sort of like just, hey, it's going to come in waves and you don't really know what's going to come from and don't judge it. And like, you're going to be on a ride now. Like, you know, it's like, even though I'm like, oh, I get it now. I don't.
Well, yeah. I don't know that you know. Yeah. I feel like that's like, you're
I was like,
alone.
Oh, like, it's more just like, yeah, welcome. And also too, knowing that, yes, as with the pandemic and seeing once I was in that journey of healing and grief and that, right, grief is from many things, loss of a relationship, a loss of a dream that you were going to have, a loss of an life that you thought you were going to have with someone. Like there's so many ways to experience grief and it isn't just about death. But even in that, hey, I lost my parent too, sort of thing. So even when somebody is in that experience, I lost my parent, where I am like, God, I know I gotcha. And also, no one's got ya. Like sort of thing. Like, welcome to the who knows, like just hang
welcome
here
to
you
the
go.
Jungle.
Yeah.
that's really it. Welcome to the jungle. Yeah. No, you're really speaking though to something that I hear all the time. It's like it is, right? We could say there's community and we can say like people will show up, but like there's you who is like intellectualizing and then spiritual bypassing and then like everything else, right? But you do what you can to survive, right? And then at some point it comes around. There's no like right way to do it, but you're right in we got you and no one's got you. That's probably the most honest thing that grief, that can really like exemplify what grief is. And yet that's the scariest bullshit I've ever heard, right? It's like, best of luck when no one's got you. Enjoy your fall.
Yeah. And I'm sitting here like trying to say this to you as like, no, like I really like get it and I don't fucking get it. But like, I got you. Like, I'm so here for you. And you're alone in your journey of your mind and your heart and your memories and your experiences and where these triggers are going to come from. And you're going to think you're fine and you're not. And then like,
and so true.
Best wishes. And I'm here.
But actually, that right there, if we can put that in, can we transcribe that later? Because that is probably the best thing to say.
I'll share this clip on.
Yeah, I'm like, that's the best thing to say. It really is. Because you are. It is. And I always say to people, like, the platitude bullshit, it's like, never tell someone, God has another angel, or an angel just got its wings, or they're in a better place, or whatever. Like, that to me is like, show up. That's bullshit. It's like the most disconnecting thing you can do to someone you care about. Just say exactly what Trisha just said, or like, I don't know what to say. I have no idea. This is so awkward. I'm really, really shit at this, but I love you and I'm here and I don't know what this experience is for you, but I want you to know that if you want to talk, I'm here. And if you want me to bring over dinner, I'm coming over later. Like whatever it is, but like, you know, the person, whatever that relationship is to be true to that relationship. And if you don't know them that well, it's like, I'm so sorry. Like, but we're so caught up in doing what's right or doing nothing at all that we miss opportunity after opportunity to make people feel less isolated in it. Because, you know, the truth is like people will feel isolated anyway, but we don't want to make them feel that way ahead of time.
Yeah. And yeah, with those, you know, the platitudes and those sorts of things, it's never helpful, but at least now I can see, and I try to always share this too, is that those people think that they're doing you a service because, like, you know, it's like, because we are so used to as humans, let's not be in our feelings. Let's not talk about it. Okay, let's move to the next thing, right? Or we are such want to be loving, caring people. So that is what we have, the world has made up is this is what we should do. Then, like, let's just say something positive here instead of being with them and the holding them, the pain of like, this fucking sucks. I'm so sorry you're going through this, that we haven't been taught to just, you can just be there in that space. Instead, it feels like we need to fix them. We need to support them. We need to show them the sunshine and whatever. And it's like,
and the silver lining,
that's the wiring
always.
Too. So also, like, when people are saying that shit to you, you can have compassion for them and be like, that actually is, you know, like, it's not your job to teach them too, but it's also like, they're not like, they might not be trying to throw the toxic stuff at you. It's that they have no fucking coping skills themselves with how to actually be a loving person. They think if I say this, maybe it'll help because I don't know what the fuck else to say. And I'm afraid to make it worse. If I tell them that sucks, is that going to make it worse for them or something? So I think it is a lot of just education. Which I think, again, like grieving and people teaching more about that is like, it's okay to not know what to say. It's okay if somebody's unhappy, if someone's sad, if someone's stuck and lost and in grief, like that is a part of life instead of acting like, okay, and next.
100%. Everything you just said is what I say in my book. So thank you for that.
Which everyone will definitely want to get and have on hand for whatever you are currently going through and grieving because but, yeah, like life is always throwing us different things. What do you think are things like, are there times in your sessions where people don't realize they're experiencing grief? Like, what are the things that people, you're like, this is grief? And they're like, no. Or like, what do you mean?
Oh my God. Yeah. All the time. You know, one of the biggest ones lately is friendship loss. And the idea that people are not feeling like they fit in with their friends anymore, or they don't, you know, friends are ghosting them, or friends are, you know, making them feel like they're not important, you know, or, you know, they just feel like every, you know, dynamic shift with people and they come in and out of our lives or something, you know, or they leave our lives, but it maybe there's nothing dramatic that happens, but they just fade away or they take space, right? But they don't know why or what they're doing. And that sense of loss is really, really big. And people don't usually talk about it in that way because it's shameful. And friendship loss, for whatever reason, and it's actually the subject of my next book, because it's so prevalent in the population that I work with, that there's a lot of, you know, cancel culture and just people saying like they don't vibe with people anymore and they just cut people off if they have problems or whatever. And there's just no patience and love. But what that does is it leaves people, the people left behind or the people dumped or ghosted in a really deep state of shame, because we're so eager to talk about our romantic breakups, but nobody wants to talk about friendship loss, because what that does is like, what's wrong with you? If you can't keep a friend, what's wrong with you? But if it's a guy, it's like, oh, it's his loss or it's her loss or it's their loss. And, you know, but with friends, it's like, what happened there? You know, and so people wind up shutting down or becoming really entrenched in shame and grief. And it's not something that people talk enough about. So we're talking about it in sessions, but it's just not out there. And so with that, especially post-pandemic, is really, really something I'm hearing a lot of.
True fact. I'm 42. I can't remember the last time I got a facial, years ago. I haven't had any stuff done. It's all because of Blissoma, my absolute favorite skincare line, which is authentic green beauty. Authentic green beauty. It's cutting edge chemistry meets traditional herbal knowledge for the best of both worlds. Their original recipes
offer a huge range of phytonutrients that benefit every skin need, including sensitivities and painful skin problems. They create balances within the skin and body. Their products are formulated to allow customers to proactively and naturally manage a variety of skin issues, including acne, eczema, sensitivities, stress, and aging through the nutrients that they contain. The technologies utilized by Blissoma during their manufacturing processes make it possible to create totally clean, synthetic-free extractions backed by proven scientific research. These aren't being made in gigantic batches that they're just pumping out and slapping on terms like organic and green and all of that and clean. Do you know that the FDA doesn't regulate that? So there's a lot of what's called greenwashing, where they make it seem like it's a lot better for you than it is, and it's still fooled with a lot of chemicals. So seriously, Blissoma skincare products have changed my skin, not just how my skin looks, but how it feels. And I didn't notice what a difference that made until I decide to go on a trip and let me just take these products that I have. They're in their little travel things already. Nope. I feel it right away and see it. Don't worry. I now have the travel sample set, so I will never do that again. Go check out Blissoma skincare products. You can do an online skin consultation on their website. You fill out a questionnaire about your skin and an actual human reads it and writes back with product suggestions for you. You can also buy a sample set or travel set to try products out. I have been using these products for a couple years now, have been recommending them, and I have never heard any negative feedback from anybody who has taken the chance to try their products. Blissoma.com. Check them out.
Yeah, that makes sense. And also just as into adulthood and continuing adulthood, and too, it is you see the jokey things on social media. It's making plans as an adult. Okay, I miss you so much. Great. How about November? How about December? It's that you really never see your friends. And it's funny. And it's also so true and sad.
Yeah.
And that's not even a friend breakup, but I do think in many ways we can be more isolated as we get older, and there's just, your lives are busy, our lives are full. And then also people realizing, oh, I do want and need more time by myself or to recharge. So I can't have as full of a schedule. So I don't see as many people. And then the picking and choosing, I myself have gone through, I still will have to call myself out of my bullshit of oh, well, I guess, is this person not even like me anymore? Are we not friends? Because we don't live in the same town, even they live across town. But they're hanging out, but they said they're busy, but then they're with that person. It's just they're making, it's that person lives 2 minutes away and this, or just it's so easily to make up these things and then be I guess I don't even have any friends anymore. Nobody likes me. What's wrong with me? It can spin into so many things because it usually has nothing to do with you. It's their life has changed. They're going through something, whatever that. And then it can feel so isolating and it can feel what does this mean about me?
Every time. Yeah. Every time. When really it's now we're friends, we forget it's not friends by meaning and values. It's friends by proximity and geographical location and desirability based on simplicity, and it's true, but it isn't. It isn't us. But I do think that it's such a sad and isolating and lonely feeling. Even you just having that conversation with your head, all right, they're posting stuff online and they were busy this week. What's going on? And when you're alone, it's easy to spin that narrative into a place that takes you off the rails. And but that's a sense of grief that we don't really think about, even just the shifting of relationships and that sense of feeling like you're not the same person. You don't have that same sense of comfort that you had before. Where do we get our comfort? We can grieve comfort. We're so busy providing ourselves with the ample amount of numbness and scrolling and doom scrolling and feeling like we're connected when we're the most disconnected we've been. And, aliens can land on the planet and we just keep on scrolling. Nobody cares. But, all of that to say is that, it's real. And yeah, And there's a lot of grief around in layers of our lives that people don't often think about until they're sitting there talking about it. So that's why I always say to my clients, like, you can come in for one thing, and I'm not planning to keep you here for 10 years, but I want you to know that this one thing is related to 25 others, and that there's never just one loss, and there's never just one trauma. And so we're there to clean out the system, not necessarily clean it out when it comes to, like, you know, just healing and processing, but we're there to really look at it all honestly and figure out ways to put the pieces together in a way that feels new and empowering to you and who you are now. And it's not always comfortable. In fact, more often than not.
Yeah. Oftentimes not, probably. Different levels of comfort, I guess. Even some ways it might be like exciting to like, let me go in here because then I know relief is here. And then, oh, no, never mind.
Oh my God. Every day. Oh no, maybe I don't want to go in that direction.
Turn back.
All the time. It's like, you know, we're always spelunking around things that we don't, you know, it's a landmine. So it is, but I don't know, you know, but I don't know another way except to get to the honesty of it all, because otherwise we do just sit in our loneliness, isolation, shame, grief, traumas, and assumptions, because we're really good at that too.
Oh my goodness. I'm so excited for your book and how amazing that you're already working on the next one. Good for
girl,
you.
I know. No, it's a... I know I had to, because of so much of what's going on in my practice with friendship loss. And I'm like, it's like there's a de-evolution of friendship going on, and I want to get to the bottom of it. And I want to maybe get people back together again.
What do you think? Like, you're working on the book, but like, yeah, like what's your top? Like, what are you wanting for people? Or like, what are you wanting to get across with that book? Like when you said you want to bring them back together.
Well, I want to bring the right people back together. But I think that I want people to understand why they become friends with the people they become friends with. Because sometimes I think that we just don't know. And then like later on down the path, we realize that we have never had anything in common with these people, or they've never actually been respectful of us, or they maybe put us down, or they're jealous or competitive, and all these things that we overlook in the beginning, or we don't notice it. And then when we like dissect it all, we realize that actually, it was always this way. And why did I become friends with them? Was it proximity? You know, there's a lot of different reasons. And so to me, it's all about kind of what I do with grief is like, let's look at it more honestly. Where's my void? Where do I fill people in? Where do I want people to fill in within me that I'm missing myself over and over and over in relationship? And then, you know, and also there's so much codependency out there that people don't understand in relationships too. So, I mean, it's a lot, Trisha.
No, I mean, I'm sure. I know there's so many people over the years that I would become friends with and then like meet other friends or like, and it would seem like a somewhat toxic, I don't want to like be throwing that word, I guess. But yeah, like I was like, I don't really understand why you're friends with that person, or okay, like this is interesting, and like not judging it, but also like, huh, this is so interesting. And then like the way that perhaps, yeah, they've been friends since high school or the blah, 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 or this and that, but like not also realizing that they maybe had permission to even change the friendship, or I don't know. There's so many layers with friends. I don't know. And that there it was are. Like, I don't understand. Okay. And I've seen now witnessing some of those people, like they did eventually pull back or like that too, but it's just so interesting. And then even seeing like, you have the choice with your own time. So you could be making plans with these people who you seem to be in a much better, exciting, more mood like with, but you're still choosing these people over those people.
Yeah.
And it's like, so some what sort is it of loyalty or like, yeah. Yeah, like why? Well, because those people would call you out or be mean to you if you didn't go out with them, like these different things where it's like, yeah, like what, why don't,
yeah.
Why are well, you it's choosing usually the these dynamics. People? What are the decisions?
It's usually like trauma, right? Like when we have friends that are like borderline abusive towards us or really disrespectful, a lot of the time it's just that we don't feel worthy of better. And, you know, and that is a very old wound that people carry, or, you know, because sometimes they don't even notice that it's happening. And when you become desensitized to disrespect, I mean, that's when things become really, really tricky and deep. And so that's, you know, that's where I like to, that's the playground I like to be in, is helping people to look at that desensitization to disrespect and that feeling of unworthiness that trails along in the background. So that's the book that I hope that we get to talk about next year.
Yeah. But I was like, that's going to take a couple of years. So like, yeah.
Now I'm working right now on the outline and the proposal, but I'll have to tell you, like, despite the fact that I really love my first book, because I really, the mission of it was to be as inclusive in terms of like clinical work and giving as many tangible tools to people who are feeling so lost in the grief process. But so now that it's done, I'm like, oh boy, it's going out in the world. Like, I'm almost so nervous about it that I want to focus on something else so that I don't have to worry about this one. But, you know, the mission of this one is so, to me, I want it to just go to its highest good. You know what I mean? Like, to me, it was something that I wrote out of a sense of a need for people that I was working with. And it was hard. It was hard.
So it was hard to write
during the pandemic. And, you know, I lost a client along the way to death, sudden death. And there was a lot, you know, in the process of writing this book that was really painful and hard and lonely. And so it's an interesting experience now that it's about to pop out into the world in, you know, 13 days. But the mission of it to me is like, wow, I didn't write this book for me in any capacity. Even though I do talk about losing my mother and being a grief therapist who's gotten grief wrong, you know,
what does that mean? What does that mean by gotten grief wrong?
Well, really just that I thought that I had I thought I had enough training and education that I would be exempt from a full, you know, a full leveled grief process.
Got it. So meaning you were already a therapist and even a trauma and grief therapist when your mother died. And so then you assumed, I will be able to handle this better.
Yes, because I have I was so arrogant. Oh boy, was I pushed down that mountain, and gratefully so, you know. I was arrogant in thinking that I wouldn't have to, you know, to grieve in the same way, despite the fact that losing my mother, you know, I lost her now 7 years ago, and it was horrific, you know. It was, you know, you lose somebody that important, you understand losing a parent is a somewhat isolating experience if you're a little bit more on the younger side and not many people have lost. So, but beyond that, I just kept like ignoring my body. And, you know, I talk a lot now about how grief is a full body experience. People don't understand it. They think that it's just emotions and your whole body gets involved. It takes endurance. I wound up in the hospital with pancreatitis weeks after my mom died and getting a thyroid condition. I mean, there was so much that my body was actually taking on that I was just ignoring. So, you know, I'm facetious when I say I got grief wrong, but it was like, I kind of did because I kind of knew better. And, you know, I just ignored a lot of the stuff that I really could have paid attention to, that I tell other people to pay attention to, and I pay attention for them. But I wasn't always great at taking care of myself or putting myself in that place. So lesson learned.
Got it. Well, and I'm sure there you go. not to be like, well, the good news is that happened for you for that other book, read a book, not like that. But I'm guessing though, because of that, you know, besides all the training and work you've done and then your own experience where you did sort of like, I know better. And then you lived through that. Like there is, besides the training and the client stuff, there's your lived experience also in the book, even from someone who's like, I got this grief thing. And was
100%. Yeah, I basically start out with that. Like, oops, like here I am. I lost my own mother and that was devastating. And, you know, a lot like you were talking about earlier in our conversation, it is, you know, having that lived experience when it comes to loss, because it's such a mysterious type of thing people go through. I think you do, in a way, have an upper hand at being a helper when you have gone through your own devastation in this way. And I don't mean that, you know, like nobody else would be able to understand, but I do think that the things that I learned along the way have made me more astute to things that could go wrong and things to pay attention to. And yeah, just being, I mean, I think, you know, loss breaks your heart open into a million pieces. And, you know, it's traumatic loss, all of that. And you have to really to look at your whole life and all of the different parts. Like, you can't just look at the loss. You have to look at everything around it. And it rearranges everything. And so I think people don't often know that. And it's a terrifying endeavor, you know? So, I mean, you understand it too. We long to just have some normalcy, which is why you went on tour looking for normalcy.
Right. Or just, yeah. And also, and then I did end up like quitting my life, like I said, for like a year. And that is not a totally rare experience. But yeah, most people also just don't even have the opportunity to have that be a choice, you know, too. Like, I didn't have a 9-to-5 job. It might have been different, not as easy for me. Maybe, I mean, it could have still too, to be like, great, I'm going back to work on Monday, and then I could have still had a breakdown and quit, like whatever. But yeah, like that, it's so often that it's just the things that happen in life besides death, loss, again, all types of loss, pregnancy loss, a relationship loss, a breakup, you lose your job, like all of these things. And then there isn't really like, don't worry about it. We got you. You just get to enter this lane over here. Like, come over to the slow lane and we got you. It's like life is still happening. Other things are piling up. You still have bills to pay. You still have whatever, people to take care of, all of that. And then your entire, and yeah, everything has been shaken up.
Totally. And it's never the same. And you don't know where it's going or where it's gone. And the world is just doing what it does. It's worlding. Everyone's right back on their own schedules with, you know, just tapping their clock saying, you know, are you better yet? Are you back to normal? Are you cool? Everything's good, you know, because we can't handle discomfort for too long, you know, just long enough. And, you know, so it's hard. But, you know, that's the hope. Look, that's why you and I write books, is to figure out a way to help people navigate something and find the strength within them, or find the goodness, or, you know, whatever it may be that we're looking deep down. As for me, it was, all right, it's here, it's happened. And it's not going to fly for me to tell people in a fast paced society that they're going to feel miserable or terrible or unpredictable for as long as they feel, and that they can just accept it and sit back and enjoy the ride. Like, that doesn't fucking fly. Not anymore. And so that was why I was like, ooh, I better help. Like, let's create something that actually goes, like, this is what we can expect, or this is what you can do if, or here's how you date again. Here's what you can tell your bosses. Hey, if you want to get out of that wedding, let's make a plan A, B, and C, you know? And so that's, to me, that was the point of writing this book for me, is like, you and I both really, after our losses, it sounds like, really just didn't really know what the hell to do. You know what, in a way? And that is almost always the case. Whether it's unexpected or it's expected, most of the time our brains just can't wrap our brains can't wrap around that information right away. And so that's where we are. But, you know, and we hope that there's somebody soft there to, you know, a soft landing at some point to guide us back to, or not back to anything, but to somewhere where we can feel alive and connected again one day.
Yeah. And that too, like, it's just like a glimmer of it. Cause it's not like you're gonna, yeah, like get back to, or it's even like, oh, okay, today I feel this. And it's like, that's why I'm, you know, the focus on joy. It's like, yeah, you can go find one thing that can bring you a little bit of joy. And it's not like I'm not allowed to feel, like you're not going to feel anything else. But like, yeah, how can you try to support yourself and nurture yourself? And if joy feels too out of the scope for whatever you're going through right now, then I'm always like, well, what can you do to nurture yourself right now? And that might end up be something that would also bring you joy. But sometimes the word joy can be triggering. How dare I allow joy into my life? So I'm like, well, what can you do to nurture yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. I always say, just if that's too big, just take it back to basics. Can you just like give yourself enough water today? Can you take a walk? Like, can you look at the sky? I don't know. Sometimes, you know, when we're aiming too big, let's just get back to basics. But it's so nice when we have guides or someone like you to remind us.
Well, so I'm so excited for your book and to now have a resource to direct people to.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
I'm going to ask you the questions I ask everybody. The first one is, what is a go-to to raise your joy levels when you might not be feeling so great?
Instantly nature. Instantly.
Yes. Okay. Ask somebody to apply this phrase to their life. What is easiest for you is not always what is best for you. That doesn't mean it's harder, but like you might be wired to be, oh, this is what's easiest for me. Oh, but this is what's best for me.
Mm-hmm. Apply it to my life.
Or like I said, a way you're naturally wired or, you know, the way.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's putting all of my attention on other people.
It's easiest for you to put your attention on other people.
Yeah.
Best for you to remember that you are a person.
Best for me to remember. Best for me to remember that I too need water.
Yeah.
And best for me to remember that I too need to take it back to basics and get fresh air sometimes and not overwork and remember my boundaries. It's easier for me not to and to tell other people to do that, you know, but yes, that one was vulnerable. I'm going to work on it though.
Yes. Okay. The name of the podcast is Claim It, which is because I feel that so often we are seeking like, oh, I'll be enough, successful, fulfilled, worthy once I, and it's usually focused on how we think that looks. Once I physically look this way, once I have this much money, once I'm in this type of relationship, whatever. And by looking at life that way, then it just ends up continuing to move even once you get those things. And so I feel like if we actually focus on what would that feel like? What does it feel like to be enough? What does it feel like to be fulfilled? What does it feel like to be successful? Then we can get pretty damn close to claiming it in that moment by focusing on what it feels like. So what are you claiming for yourself right now?
I am claiming the allowance of my voice in this conversation of loss, of a bigger conversation. I'm claiming the allowance of my voice to be heard.
Yes, love it. It's a powerful, such a necessary, such a needed voice. Thank you for allowing
your
voice to be heard and putting it out there.
Thank you. That one came right at the moment here where I was then, it circles back to little Gina, right? I want to claim to have that voice, that little, like that 12, 13 year old Gina had when she was running for office and belief that she could be chosen. And so, yeah, so I claim that my book too can be chosen along with the others, that there's room for me. So
there's so much room. There's a lot of books out in this world. There's a lot of overlap. I'm sure there are grief books, but I really think, and I really think your book is fucking needed.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. I feel like we talked so much about the friendship book. I better get on it now.
Yeah, I'm holding you to that. No.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Again, go check out Gina's book. Moving on doesn't mean letting go. And also, you know, as I talked about, even us, those of us who have experienced deep grief ourselves can still be like, what the heck do I do now that somebody else that I love is experiencing it? And perhaps this book is going to be a great one to have and to hit, you know, purchase for, to send to our loved ones when they are navigating all sorts of loss of a pet, loss of a loved one, loss of a relationship, loss of a job. There are so many ways to experience loss. Okay, moving on, doesn't mean letting go. And of course, if you haven't gotten my book yet, pick up F the Shoulds, Do the Once. You can go to yourjoyologist.com/gift and you can download the first chapter of my book, F the Shoulds, Do the Once, for free, as well as some guided sort of like heart meditations. Not really meditations, they're more like love notes. Speaking of that, make sure to subscribe for my daily text messages. Go to yourjoyologist.com/text. You can use code JOY3 to get a discount off your first 3 months every single day. I sent out a text message right to your text messages. You don't have to go to social media. You don't have to open your email inbox. It comes right to your text. So then it's also easy to scroll through and see past ones. And they are to love you up, get you out of your own way, remind you what matters, all that good stuff. Go to yourdrologist.com/text.